Even my cousin Richard Brown.
Yes, yes.
I think I'm going to go back and do his
class again.
Sure. Sure, I've done it a couple of times. It's great fun. It's fun. Good morning.
Hello.
How are you?
I saw you in the drink line last night. Gene Wolfe from
Hiya. Yes.
I also saw you on screen.
The last time I think some of us got to talk to you was for All That Jazz, and you talked about how physically demanding that role was. This one may have been physically demanding in a different way. I mean, you're seated in the plane. You're not running or dancing or whatever, but...
Well, the physical demands here were involved in a lot of anxiety. I mean, about flying all that stuff. I mean, as you know, Malcolm and I spent hours and hours and hours in that helicopter, and we participated in the stunts. There was no other way. I mean, rear projection in the daytime is lousy. You can't fake it. So we were up there doing it. And I think one of the things that makes the movie particularly exciting is the fact that it's not special effects, it's really people in the aircraft. I mean, I flew that business through the aqueduct about four or five times. And that does make one a little nervous.
But when you were asked to take those risks, did you think it was fair for a director to ask you to do that?
Yeah, because he did it too. He flew them. He flew them before we did. He checked it out first. Of course, when he flew it, they went through like this. When I flew it, they went through like this.
You were actually piloting the...
No. 2 or 3 feet behind me would be the stunt pilot.
Right.
And then the cameras would be on me, excluding him. But he's flying the stunt, and I'm in the aircraft.
Right. Okay.
And after a while... I had done some flying, and these guys would let me take it off and, you know, set it down and play around. So after a while, I got pretty proficient.
I heard someone say the star of this movie is the helicopter. I've heard that said so often.
I mean,
let's get to the bottom
of this. Nonsense. I mean, without the... See, unlike Jaws, the shark is totally animal. In Blue Thunder, the machine doesn't function without a man in it. So the Blue Thunder changes its personality when Malcolm's in it and when I'm in it. And I think this movie is definitely about it. I mean, you're not rooting for the machine up there. You're rooting for Murphy. So, no, I don't think the machine is the star of the movie.
As far as persona goes, however, between this and Still of the Night, two different kinds of Roy Scheiders, in my opinion.
Yes, very different.
How do you respond to one or the other? Do you have is one more of a favorite of yours to pursue in the future?
No,
like
I mean,
balance?
The challenge of the acting is different in both cases, and actors like that. They love to do other different, totally different things.
So the sense of balance is
yeah,
desirable.
I think it's healthy to do as many different things as possible. It is a little bit annoying, though, when you read criticism of the film, as there was much criticism of Still of the Night, mostly because the picture was advertised as a romantic thriller, and when you do that, comparisons to Hitchcock are inevitable. And although there are some Hitchcockian things in the film, it's not really the kind of a film that Benton wanted to make. I mean, if anything, it's more European. It's more like a Chabrol film than a Hitchcock film. And in that film, I play a very genteel, very decent, kind, a man of inaction, really. I mean, his action is in his psychiatrist's office. But in life, he's almost a mama's boy, really. And he's a relatively dull guy. So when I see criticism, Roy Scheider certainly is so dull in this movie. That's what I'm playing. I mean, it really is disheartening when you don't realize that some critics who should know better don't recognize the difference between story and character and performance. They don't seem to see that that's, you know, they could perhaps criticize the structure and the plot of the film and say that perhaps these characters weren't as dynamic as they should have been. But Merle and I were doing our assignment. We were, you know... They say Meryl Streep was so strange we didn't give a damn about her, or that she was so neurotic and this and that. Well, that's what it's about. That's the character.
When you say just do your assignment, I can't imagine you picking up a part and just doing your assignment.
Oh, no.
Don't you accuse it
of
that?
Oh, sure you do. Sure you do. But it's very important that you feel that this guy normally would never for the world be involved in any kind of
playing against.
Yes, I mean all of it frightens and scares him.
And suddenly there you are with a cigarette lighter.
All of that stuff.
All the tension in the world.
Yeah, I mean this is a guy who thrives on things being very normal and ordered in his life. He's not a man of action like Murphy, who drives his car out of the garage like a lunatic to see if he can keep from knocking over those things. I mean, the character in Still of the Night wouldn't dream of doing anything like that.
You talked about all that jazz being one part where you got to portray all the dimensions. Is that the kind of thing you're looking for again?
It's the kind of thing every actor's looking for. I mean, for instance, Meryl in Sophie's Choice, that's a very rich three-dimensional character, giving her a chance to play many things, many ages, many moods, as I had an opportunity to do in all those jazz, and those parts don't come along very often. I mean, good parts come along, but really rich parts, not too often.
Without maybe compromise is too strong a word, you take other parts in between because there isn't an all that jazz.
That's right. You take whatever is the best available, the best piece of property, or the most interesting challenge available, and you're just not going to hit great roles of great dimension that are offered to you or that are written, that exist. There are not that many around that exist, period.
So when you take a role like Blue Thunder will be judged, is the word artistically appropriate, but it also, the real test of Blue Thunder, it's a money movie. I mean, that even the PR people, that's a money movie. It's got dollars.
Well, what they mean is that it's a huge entertainment piece that will appeal to a very broad audience. And the people certainly feel like they got their $5 worth in this movie. So does that answer your question?
Well, in a way, but I mean, in other words, your ability here is going to be judged on pulling in an audience less than on creating a character, yes? No?
Well, again, if the character of Murphy isn't created very carefully, you're not going to care about much in that wild duel at the end. I mean, the aerial combat. I mean, Murphy is very carefully set up for you to have a rooting interest in him. And I think he is the glue that holds the movie together. The same way that the character in Jaws, the sheriff, was a representation of the audience. I mean, he was the one who had all the fears about water, worried about his children, worried about the people on the beach, was not particularly a man hell-bent for revenge like Shaw's character, or scientifically motivated like Dreyfus's character. But he was the guy that the audience followed, and through him, they have the adventure. Well, through Murphy again in this film, the audience has their adventure. And often the character who plays the audience is the one that never gets reviewed. Because the audience feels it's them. So they think you're there on automatic.
Can I ask you a question about that?
Sure.
Because you just really blew my mind. The character Brody in Jaws, I absolutely see is exactly what you just said. He's Mr. Average
That's
guy.
That's right.
He's very responsible, and yet he acts irresponsibly. One time when he lets that little kid go in, and the wife says to him, you knew, and he's guilt-stricken. He's not Superman, but the character Murphy doesn't strike me as being that kind of a guy at all. And that he's so
No. I'm not saying.
Unique.
Yeah, there are. I mean, in Murphy is a much more tense, much more hostile guy. I mean, he's a Vietnamese pilot. He's got a lot of guilt and hostility in him about that war, about his participation in it. I only made the parallel in that he's the character that the audience follows all the way through in the picture. When he decides to take action, the audience feels terrific because it's the action that they would want to take. They would want to take this Blue Thunder up and show all these fools how dangerous and dumb this machine is to have. What a threat it represents. I meant it that way. I didn't mean that the characters were similar. I meant that their purpose in the film is similar.
given that Jaws 3D doesn't take place anywhere near, I gather, or maybe it does, where the original Jaws story was shot in Florida, SeaWorld, but I don't know where it's located.
I think the premise is that a shark is loose in an amusement park.
Right. Yeah. But was there ever, I mean, you made it quite clear to the press you didn't want to do another Jaws movie. I think that's true. But did the producers of Jaws 3D ever call you, ever sit down, did they take you to lunch and say...
They knew better. You see, after I pleaded insanity and went crazy about doing Jaws 2, I mean, they had a... You know, the deal on Jaws 2 was that when Steven cast me on Jaws 1, the studio said no. And Steve said, what are you talking about? No. So, well, yes, if he agrees to do other pictures for us. So then Steve calls me and says, look, Roy, this is what Universal says. If you, I said, okay, I want to do the picture with you, I'll find something to do with Universal. Unfortunately, the stuff that Universal sent me was lousy, but my option time was running out. And it ran out. In between that, I did Marathon Man, I did Sorcerer, and finally there was no escape. And they said, here's Jaws 2, fella. If you're not going to do this, you're not going to work. And that's how I wound up being in Jaws 2. So it was not a choice on my part. It was a mistake on my part to make the deal the way I made it in the first place. But then I'm not sorry because I had a great time on Jaws.
Suppose Jaws 3D becomes a blockbuster this summer.
Probably will.
What, would you have any feelings that maybe it would have been fun to stick with?
It would have been no fun, and I don't want to participate. I mean, I feel that no matter what Jaws 3 looks like, on the basis of the first two films, on the basis of the popularity of the name Jaws alone, it'll gross over $50 million in the United States and as much overseas, no matter what it is. But I'm not going to be sad about it. I wish them all the luck in the world. I'm just happy that I could afford not to do it.
What are you doing in between when you're not making movies? What's life like? Itchy? Wishing you were on the set?
Yeah, I mean, and I used to say to journalists, well, you know, I read a lot and I go to the museums and I go to dinner with my friends and I go to the theater and I pursue all those things. Well, I do all those things, but most of the time is spent trying to find another good property to do, to get myself back into action again, you know, reading and making phone calls and finagling and shifting and meeting with authors and meeting with producers and trying to get something really worthwhile to do next. And that's a lot of anxiety is attached to that. When those periods stretch into months, you get very nervous. I mean,
What's the nervousness about?
The nervousness about is that, you know, you have all those fears of you're never going to work again, or you're never going to find any good properties, you never got a chance to do something really that you're really excited about. I mean, I'm fortunate enough that I'm not at a loss for scripts being sent to me, but they're not always things I want to do. And when I can continue to turn things down, I get very nervous, thinking that, God, isn't anything good going to come? And then I go out, I have now many projects that I'm either co-writing or co-producing or co-something or other to try and get them going. But often they're not necessarily the most commercial ones.
Looking for a rich role like All That Jazz.
Yeah, but I'm trying to create something interesting that I want to play and do.
What are the things about yourself we haven't seen yet? What are the things that you want to make sure you don't miss doing?
For instance, there's a lady writer in New York by the name of Judith Ross, who's written some plays and some very good screenplays, and she has a wonderful romantic comedy that I like a lot. And although a lot of studios are crazy about it, they're a little nervous about making that kind of a picture. I hope that in the future their attitude will change. But for instance, that's something I would like to do next, is a really good adult romantic comedy.
How do you know that before it even gets to you, a lot of good properties, because they're not written by main people?
Oh, where a good idea is going to come from.
But hopefully a romantic comedy would spare you the rigors of the location work in something like Sorcerer.
Yeah.
What happened to Sorcerer? I loved Sorcerer. Were you disappointed in how that worked out?
Sure, I was disappointed. But I'll tell you what the problem was there. Mr. Friedkin had in his mind to make what he called an existential melodrama. Now, that's almost a contradiction in itself. And the movie was, I think, well done, meticulously done, beautifully photographed, well acted. However, it didn't have enough, for lack of a better word, heart, in that it didn't allow the audience to get emotionally involved with the guys.
That's the situation that we're involved with, not the
every
characters.
Every time the audience was put into a frightening or scary situation, there never was enough time in the cutting to allow the audience to vent their emotional reaction. For instance, you can't take a truck and put it on a bridge for 10 minutes in the film, put it through hell, the storm, the water, everything going on, and then the moment the truck gets to the other side, and you, when you cut inside the cab, you've got to see the guys going, yay, or whatever, for some amount of time to allow the audience to experience that, because you've just put them through hell. And Billy was so, and his cutting was so sharp and cold, he didn't allow the audience to participate in the movie. So they found themselves and falling down all the time. But again, that's the kind of film he wanted
when
to make.
When you see The Wages of Fear, the so
sure.
They do get involved.
Of course they do.
There's that wonderful delirium of happiness at the end. Yeah. When you work with a director, is it often that you will become aware of maybe some of the problems, in your opinion, about what he's doing?
Yes, and that leads to extensive discussions and sometimes arguments. Well, not fights. I mean, I know him well enough. I've been with him on two pictures, French Connection and this one. And I always felt, I just said, look, you're just not letting the folks in on this one. I mean, it's all terrific stuff, but they're not going to leave the theater whistling Sorcerer.
I think the title had a lot to do with the problem.
Yes, especially following Exorcist with that title is dangerous, very dangerous.
Going back to your comments about what you may have considered to be unfair reviews or reviews that didn't understand the difference between character and your performance.
I mean, don't misread me. I think the critics are entitled to dislike a movie if they want to.
Okay, I understand. But what I'm saying is, does an actor, or do you ever worry that producers and directors reading this negative thinking might say, well, maybe we shouldn't go with Roy, he didn't do it.
Damn right. That's my livelihood. I don't enjoy reading reviews that say one of Mr. Scheider's dullest and most uninteresting performances. That
but
hurts.
Do you think they can't see beyond it?
Obviously they can't. I mean, they've seen me in other pictures. Aren't they aware that I'm trying to do something else? Can't they see that? And they killed me. They killed me. They said, what is she playing? Well, given the character and given the fact that she had to play the duality of wanting you to like her and care about her and at the same time being the murderer, I mean, she was always stuck with that acting problem. And she would often say to the director, now, wait a minute, am I playing this as the murderer or am I playing this as the heroine?
But you didn't have any situation where after those reviews appeared, a producer said, Roy, we're really going to pass on this one. It didn't.
No,
really
I don't know about that.
Oh, okay.
But I don't. I cannot believe that producers aren't affected by what they read.
Okay.
And that they don't think the same things themselves when they're watching the movie. So, of course, all of that is important to me. It's important to your career.
You've kidded about what happens when you become a star and a sex symbol. How was that kind of thing that happens to you, that sex symbol thing, affected your marriage?
Well, because I happened to be married to a woman who was a very fine actress herself, and now is one of the top editors in the business. She understands that aspect of the business very well.
Can you always understand that aspect of the business when it's coming at you?
I can, because I think I understand the mystery of movies. And movies take place in a big black fantasy land where you have a 40-foot face. And people, you become something larger and more romantic than life. And when moviegoers see you, it's like you know, they're in, it's in, like they're in the shock. They don't believe their own eyes. In fact, I've walked down the street with people walking towards me, and I see them going, and they think they're losing their minds. So as they go by, I've often said, yeah, it's okay, it's me. Yeah. Relax. Sure, sure. So, I think I understand, and she certainly understands it. I mean, you know, she's always, she'll say to me, did you see those people the way they were looking at you? And I don't see it anymore.
Oh, you really don't see
it. I see it, but it's like, I've seen it enough now so that peripherally, it's just sort of, it's just there, and I don't think much about it. It's part of the landscape, yeah.
Do you think
and believe me, you know, she knows the guy she lives with. He's as temperamental and as can be as boorish as all of us can be at home. Sure. Are we shifting? I've had.